dwelling in the darkest depths of the mind. It's time for Mark D. Valenti and Brain Burrow.
Hello, everybody. This is Mark D. Valenti, and this is another episode of Brain Burrow. This is our digging deep session where we have a chance to talk with our guest. Our guest has a chance to talk about his life, his values. What does he want for himself? What does he fear? What is he motivated by? And then you as a listener and viewer have a chance to say, how does this apply to me? So I'm very pleased to have on the show today, Mr. Walter Phelan, and I'm going to hand it over to him by asking him the big open-ended question. Who exactly is Walter Phelan?
That is a good question. I don't know. Let's see. I'm kind of a jack of all trades, and I'm a musician. I play the drums and have my whole life, and I do a little acting, and I work on, I do makeup effects, which I still do. And I've always been a big horror fan and a sci-fi fan. And, you know, I'm a kid, I'm a product of the 60s. So, you know, when I was a little kid and growing up, everything was, you know, the Beatles and Universal Monsters. So that was kind of like my whole world when I was a child, Batman included, you know, and moved around a lot. And through the 60s and 70s, always just kept watching horror films and always my favorite genre of movies. You know, that led into the 70s from Universal stuff into Hammer stuff and then into slasher stuff later. And it was always in the background, sort of monsters was always in the background. And the idea of being a monster in the movie always intrigued me, even from when I was a little kid. So I was fascinated by those guys. I was like, you never, you know, some of them you'd see who they were, but most of the time you didn't know who the guy was, you know. And I always found that very fascinating. And by the time, and I learned how to play music and basically spent most of my life pursuing that and living in Los Angeles and playing clubs and, you know, started in the late 70s and then spent most of the 80s in the punk rock world in Los Angeles and used to play, I had a band called RF7 and we used to play with Circle Jerks and Black Flag and Social Distortion and Bad Religion and that whole era of punk rock, which was like maybe second or third wave LA punk, which the waves came very quick, very fast, you know. And after a few years of that, I dropped out of that scene, became very, became very violent and very gang oriented from how it started as this very communal type of thing where, you know, all these youngsters in their 20s and teens were trying to reinvent music again, you know, and showing that anybody could do it, which was the wonder of punk rock. Because in the late 70s, when we started, when I started out being, you know, making it music seemed like such an intangible thing. You know, rock stars were just richer than shit and, you know, platform shoes, and giant shows and, you know, and it was like that was the thing we wanted, but it was so, you had no idea how to get to it. And that was kind of the wonder of punk rock. It brought it back to a DIY thing where anybody could do it, you know. And it was really, really fun times. And continued playing. And I play to this day. I play with Pat Todd. And we're Pat Todd and the Rank Outsiders. And we are kind of an all-American band. Pat Todd's been around for, well, he's 67 now. And we record a lot and tour. And we're very, I say American music. We play just about every kind of genre of American music, you know, from a jug band to punk rock to, you know, we're all over the place. So that's what I'm doing currently and still working in makeup effects. I work for Legacy Effects in LA and we're currently on Guardians of the Galaxy 3.
Wow.
Yeah, which is a long, long shoot. And, but I'm doing all pre-production stuff. So I work in the shop. I run foam latex. That's my mainstay. And then just work general stuff around the shop. That's kind of where we sit now.
Yeah. I mean, the way you talk about it, it's just such a prolific life that you've led there, Walter. I mean, you've done so many different things across the board. So I guess maybe that leads to a follow-up question. Out of everything you've done, out of everything that you do, what do you like doing the most?
Music has always been my main passion.
Okay.
Yeah, that's why I still do it and make no money at it. But we constantly record and tour, and it's what gives us life, really. And acting and being in films and working in makeup effects sort of just came about when I was in my 30s. So it wasn't something I had really pursued throughout, you know, my younger years through my 20s. And I needed a gig. I needed money because music is very hard to make money at, you know. And it was like, what did I like? Well, I like monster movies. And then just through happenstance, I happened to have met a makeup artist in LA, actually through a cousin of mine who's an electrician and happened to have fixed an oven for a guy he knew who was a makeup artist and a special effects guy. And instead of paying him, he just said, why don't you hire my cousin? He's really interested, you know, in the stuff, which was me. And then just kind of met different people. That was Scott Coulter. Through him, I met Todd Masters, started working with him in the early 90s. And we did Tales from the Crypt. And that was the main thing we were doing. And then Demon Knight, things like that. And once I finally convinced him to put me in a suit, then that kind of took off. And mostly I did a couple Tales from the Crypt episodes. And then when that, when the final season of that, they went right into making the film. So we did Demon Knight right after that. And so I played one of the demons in that and a few other monsters too. And through that, other shops like K&B saw that movie and they had Dusk Till Dawn in pre-production. So a couple of us got hired to be in that. And through that, I met other makeup artists and it kind of snowballed. So through the 90s, I was working quite a bit, still doing makeup effects, you know, but doing a lot of suit work and a lot of acting. And that was a really good time. And then that died off for a while. Things come and go, you know, become, you know, there's a new kid on the block usually or something like that.
Sure.
Don't do a lot of suit work anymore, a little bit, some puppeteering like for legacy effects and stuff like that. But yeah, you know, you hang around long enough and you end up doing different things. As long as there's a door open and you stick your toe in it, you know, usually.
That's a good way to say it.
End up doing a bunch of different stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so that says a lot, right? That horror had such a big impact on you through your entire life that you really connected to these monsters. And I want to hear more about what that meant for you and then what it did mean for you to finally become these monsters, basically, you know, that you've been so connected to through your life. So I guess maybe that's the first question, you know, why were you so drawn to these ideas of the universal monsters, the Hammer horror monsters, all of those?
I think maybe like you feel maybe like an outsider or something. I don't know. You know, I came from like a divorced family and had to move around when I was little a lot. And so I've never really felt like, you know, I had like a roots anywhere, you know. I just kind of felt like a vagabond, kind of an outsider, and was even through my teens and stuff. I just sort of, and I think a lot of monster fans feel that way. So they identify with the monster who's the outsider in the film, you know, and is usually not even, I mean, especially in the older films and Universal films, they're not evil, really, you know. I mean, besides maybe Dracula, most of them are not evil. They're just these beings that have, you know, most of them have no choice that they're, you know, what's happened to them is happening. And so I always pitied those guys, you know. Mm. And there's the outsider thing. Maybe that's what it is. I don't know. And just the fascination also of transformation and how to, you know, how they did that. Like as a little kid, I remember I know I didn't have a connection to the monster and the makeup that they were wearing, like when I'm 6, 7, or I mean, yeah, I don't know if any kids really have that.
Sure.
You know, really, really smart. But of course, you know that they're not people and they don't, that's not their real face, but still, I don't know. I didn't have that until much later, that connection. Even when I was, I guess, 7, we lived in San Fernando Valley, and the Munsters was on, of course, and that was the greatest thing ever. It was really important to me, you know, that was my favorite thing. And my sister and I happened to be on Lancashire Boulevard, not far from Universal Studios. And I don't know what we were doing there. I think maybe my mom was a waitress and worked in a restaurant down there or something. I forget. Anyways, we're walking down the street and I see a Volkswagen Beetle, and I can see this vividly now. And Frankenstein's monster was in it. Well, it was Herman Munster. And they pull into a liquor store and it's him and maybe a grip or something, you know, some other, you know, crew member. And I don't know if they're buying beer or what they're doing, but he's in full makeup, sitting in the passenger seat in a bug, a little Volkswagen Beetle, which is pretty small. Right. Fred Grin, he's pretty big, you know. So I dash off into the traffic over to the car. And sure enough, yeah, he's in full makeup and it's kind of greenish and blue. And of course, it was a black and white TV show. So that was bizarre to me. And his little electrode on one side is hanging off. So I remember, I can see this as vivid as when it happened, you know. And he reached in the back and had some 8x10s of the family and signed it for me. And
wow.
Long lost. That thing is long lost. But yeah, so that was one of those things with the makeup and the real person and then the what you see on TV. And that, I just remember that it was just fascinating. I didn't know why his electrode was off, because I thought that was really him with the makeup, you know.
Right.
And anyways, I tried that a couple times on shows, you know. I'd be in makeup and guys were going to the store or whatever. It's like, let me ride along, let's see what happens, you know.
Oh really? Okay.
Usually nobody pay any attention, or they'd look and look away right away, you know.
Wow. So obviously that's such an impact on you that you try to recreate it as an adult who happened to be in the same situation.
Well, yeah. And I don't know. So yeah, that whole thing, like I said, maybe it's the outsider thing. Mm. And also, you know, I think I'm pretty shy. I always have been, and kind of introverted. So acting for me is just like your face and your emotions and your eyeballs and getting really into you. That was never something I ever wanted to even do, you know. And so wearing the suits, there's always that wearing a suit or a makeup, there's this protective shield, you know, where I just felt freer to be able to you know, expose myself more. Because acting, you know, acting, most of the thing, and a lot of stuff I do is all stunts and things like that, although I've had quite a few scenes where, you know, I have to do dialogue, even if it's overdubbed by somebody else, but the timing has to be right. It's usually very complicated because usually in a suit, it's hard to talk. You can't see. You've got big giant hands or weird fingers on. You have a lot of, right. You know, a lot to do all at once. And so a lot of timing and hitting marks where there are no like open air marks, just turning your head or where your hand goes, things like that, which I always kind of felt my drumming came in handy with that, because okay. Because I used to practice also just shutting my eyes and playing the drums and kind of know where, picture where everything is in my mind. So I always use that when I'm in a suit, especially when I'm blind, which was about half the time. They just build something and it's like, I can't see, you know, I can't see.
Right.
And usually the guys are like, yeah, what you know what to do. You're fine, you know. And so, yeah, a lot of that I think I took from drumming and put it into my suit acting. And just as far as timing and knowing where to hit blind marks and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know what I was trying to say.
No, it's okay. Well, again, the show's about you, right? And what your experiences are. So I think, one, it's remarkable that you actually saw Herman Munster in the street. Mm-hmm. And then two, that it impacted you so much. And then again, you know, as a kid watching, as you said, these misunderstood quote unquote monsters, and being able to transform into some of these characters, obviously, you know, Demon Knight. I actually just had William Sadler on the show a couple of weeks ago Demon Knight. Yeah. So like, obviously a very iconic film. So, but obviously, House of a Thousand Corpses and as Dr. Satan. I mean, I'm just wondering what it was like to do that. What was it like to be that character?
Well, that once again, and that was quite later on. I've been doing quite a bit of stuff. So I knew Wayne Toth, who does all of Rob's makeup and all of his stage props and stuff like that. He used to work for KMB, and he was just one of their many makeup artists. And the first time I met him was on Dusk Till Dawn, and he ended up doing my makeup on that day in and day out. And who was also one of the vampires in it. Tangent, that's cool thing about KMB effects, Greg Nicotero and Howard Berger, is a lot of the movies they do where there's like groups of monsters and a lot of zombies or whatever, those will all be like their makeup guys. You get to sculpt their own makeups and they'd be in the films and stuff, which is another really cool fandom thing because they all love monsters too. And they all want to be monsters too. You know, I always thought that was really great about KMB. So anyways, through Wayne, I mean, that movie, Rob had finished it and cut it. And I'm sure most people know the stories behind it. He cut the film, gave it to Universal, and they said, well, we want to see this guy. You talk about him for 2 hours, you never see this Dr. Satan, which of course Rob didn't want him in the movie.
Right.
He wanted it to just, the audience could make it up. You know, Rob's he's very spontaneous, but he, you know, he has his ideas. He did not want that to even be. He wanted you to think it was grandpa, or maybe it was this or that, or it didn't even exist, or it was just something they used to lure people in.
Right.
So they paid for 2 weeks of shooting, and that's when I came in. And so he basically went to Wayne and who designed, you know, I have a drawing, which I think Rob did, a sketch drawing, which looks close to what the finished thing was. And then he just lets, you know, Wayne take off and sculpt it. So he just asked Wayne who we thought would be good for it. And I still was working quite a bit and here and there with Wayne. So he's like, oh, Walter's great. You know, skinny as a rail. He'd be great. He'd pop in, do it, you know, right on the bat. Right. So that's how it came about. And I didn't know much about it. I knew a little bit about Rob. I knew White Zombie. I think I had one of their albums. And but other than that, you know, I didn't know much about it at all. And that's how most of my work was. I, you know, I wouldn't get a script or anything and just kind of show up, get the makeup on, get a little bit of this is what's happening. Sometimes it really wouldn't matter what the monster was, whether it's a zombie or a vampire, except for as far as how I would work my body or, you know, my movements. And it just went really quick. I was there 3 days. And got into makeup, didn't shoot. Went second day, didn't get into makeup, just went home. The third day, got into makeup and shot. And it was real fast. And Rob was shooting at least two units at one time. So he was running all over the place. They had those catacomb sets.
Oh, yeah.
And then the big room with Dr. Satan and all the patients and all that. And which unfortunately didn't get shot as much as they hoped. And not... Mm. It was such an awesome set. And so, yeah, shot one day. Rob's just, he's just like kind of, you can just do what you want, you know, what's his name? You're operating on him. And then she's going to come through the door and you look up and say a little garbly line. And which I still can't remember exactly what the line was. It was like, welcome to hell. Or it was like, do you like what you see? Or something like that, which then he just audioed. He's just garbled it. You cannot make out what it is. And so we did that a couple times. Then he's like, let's put a sheet on the guy and cover up the blood. We'll do a TV version. And then, and that was it. So it was like, you know, besides waiting as they set everything up, we shot that for maybe an hour.
Wow. Maybe. Okay.
Yeah.
That's it.
So things like that would go really quick. I had no idea what the story was, what the movie was about. It looked weird. The costume was awesome. The makeup was fantastic. And then, and the set and the arm things and everything. I mean, it was just so cool looking. And then it was over and I went home and Wayne Toth called me the next day and said, oh man, drag, all the footage was out of focus.
Oh no.
So I'm like, well, he's not going to be in it? And he's like, no, I'm sure Rob will do something. So, which he did. So what, if you realize that, so a lot of the footage we shot wasn't even used. It was out of focus. And then whatever was left over, of course, burned up at Universal during one of their fires. Because all that,
wow,
all that stuff was, yeah. And which is a big drag. That's why Rob's never had any extra stuff to put out on that film, because it got lost, you know.
Right.
And there was, because there were extra things we shot sort of on the side also. And not long after that, we did a, Rob was shooting a video for Zach Wilde and his band. And he had Sid there in the makeup and was shooting like extra stuff for the movie during this video shoot, which was really cool, which I've never seen. And okay. It was Sid in the makeup with a little puppet that looked like Captain Spaulding. I don't know whatever happened to that footage.
Oh, interesting. Maybe. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think that's, again, first of all, thanks for sharing that story and your experience on there. And obviously as an iconic character, I mean, how did that impact you? And like, cause obviously you go to cons and you are part of that. It's part of you.
It opened that whole door. Although, you know, I'd been doing it for 20 years before that and had been in not bad stuff, pretty high profile stuff. Like, say, I mean, as far as horror films go, Demon Knight and Dust Till Dawn and Wishmaster and some X-Files and Buffy and, you know, is doing pretty high profile stuff. But as far as cons go, I was doing Amityville Horror and I did a few shots in that as Jack Ketchum, who's the cowboy ghost in it.
Sure.
Like three or four little scenes in there. And this guy kept bugging me saying, hey, you know, I do these con things. You want to do that? And I thought, well, that sounds creepy. Why would I want to do that? You know, people look at me and what? Do what?
Right.
Me? No, that sounds horrible. And he kind of kept bugging me. And I did a few and they were, there wasn't much to them. And this is early 2000s. And I'm like, these aren't very good. These, you know, and then I think I did, and then went out to Jersey and did that big Jersey con, which has been around for a long time. And that thing was great. That was really fun. And then went to Toronto and did this Fan Expo thing. And Alice Cooper was there, which is one of my favorite things of all time. So I got to sit next to him and I brought a suitcase full of records, all kinds of shit. Had him sign all kinds of stuff for me. It was great. And he put the year on it, which was a drag, but still I got all kinds of Alice stuff signed. So I was really happy. I actually had more fun doing that than, you know, treating my own fans and stuff. So eventually that just kind of snowballed. And of course the con thing is a weird phenomenon where, I mean, in the 90s, even when I first started working in makeup effects and really studying it, and there was Fango, that was it,
right?
That was the only convention, and it would come to a few cities, you know. And then there was that Jersey Con, which was a huge, but more like that's more like pop culture, so it's not definitely only horror, you know. They had everybody had a thing like that. And but the horror con thing now, where, I mean, you can go to a horror con every month of the year now.
Yeah, it seems like.
And then by Halloween, there's tons of them. And I mean, it's amazing. And I guess those fans were always out there that much, but maybe not, you know, because I remember going to some Fangos in the 90s and in LA, and there'd be, you know, people there, but not out of hand, you know, or anything.
Sure.
And these cons now, I mean, the horror fans, it's amazing how many people come to these things. It blows my mind, actually.
No, I totally agree.
And it'd be any time in the year. Halloween, forget, doesn't even matter anymore. Of course, there is a bigger generation of just people who live kind of that way all the time.
Yeah.
Like most of the kids in the 20s who we work with, I mean, it's kind of horror 24/7. Everybody's tatted up and spiked up, and it's kind of Halloween all year round.
Right.
It's just bizarre. And but the phenomenon of the con thing is really, it blows my mind.
Yeah.
They get bigger and bigger. I don't know. It's really fun. And, I almost hate going because inside, I don't like to do anything. You know, of course I do anyways, but you know, inner feelings, you know, sometimes I just like, I don't want to do anything. I like to sit on the couch and watch TV, you know?
Sure.
And, but once you're there doing it, it's so much fun. And I really do love just, talking to people from all over the place about, you know, just about working and Hollywood and there's some people show up and are real snooty, and I never understand why people would show up at cons and be snooty when they're signing autographs, you know.
Right.
I guess they're just there for the money or whatever.
Sure.
But I'm much more interested in just talking to people about it and people who are interested in it and live, you know, on the East Coast or wherever. And I always talk them out of going to schools, which most of the time, at least I don't have any connections, so nobody get mad about that. But I find the makeup school thing another phenomenon, which I don't like. There's a lot of them, and they take advantage of people. Mm. And, kids come out of those schools and owe 20, 30, 40 grand to them. And then they move all the way to California. And then maybe they get into a shop, which there's not very many shops anymore like there used to be. And what are they going to make?
Right.
You know, they're going to come in and make 10 bucks an hour and be on a crew casting stuff, you know, crew of, and usually females are most of them that come out of all girls come out of makeup schools. And then they're in LA where you can't afford to live in California. So,
right.
Yeah. So I see a lot of them, they come and they work like on a big show at Legacy, which turns into a kind of a factory thing. We're on Guardians 3 right now. Mm-hmm. That's a 7-month shoot. And there are so many makeups and masks and we do the costuming, the makeups, background masks, everything. It's just daunting amount of work in such a short time. I think it ends at the end of March, and I'm on Christmas vacation now, and I'll be going back to LA. I live in Oregon now, so I'll be going back to LA through probably February and work on that some more.
Wow.
But it's just daunting, and production times are so short now. A lot of guys left the business a few years ago. Rick Baker left the business. He wasn't going to do work on these short, lower money, shorter time.
Sure.
No decisions are made till like the last second. It's crazy. So I think still productions think we just pull stuff off shelves where it's not.
Right.
You have a makeup or anything, it starts from zero. There's nothing there.
Yeah, from scratch.
You got to have a design. Then you got to, you know, make that practical, whether you're sculpting it or having it grown in a computer, which now that's a fascinating thing. A lot of molds are now being grown, and they're finding more materials that you can actually bake really hot. Like you have to, if you're going to do foam latex or something, you know, foam latex, of course you have to mix it, get in a mold and then bake it for hours. And, so we're seeing more. Legacy Effects is very cutting edge, and they love, that. So most things are scanned now. Most, you know, people are scanned for their makeups, which is kind of close to doing a life cast, but still it's not exact to me. But life casting still happens. They still do, you know, actual life casting. But the fascinating thing, then these molds get grown, and like we do Mandalorian show and Boba Fett and all of those Disney Star Wars shows out of Legacy.
Wow.
Which is probably the most fun I've had in years in the shop. 30 years of doing work, it's like driving a truck or, you know, it's a regular job. And then having all that Star Wars stuff, like a couple of years ago when we started Mandalorian, it was like, oh, look, there's a whole rack of Tusken Raider masks. That's awesome.
Right.
And then we started making this little baby Yoda guy, and we're like, what? Okay. It was great. You know, and we had to keep that under wraps.
Right. For of course.
Months. It was great how they kept that a secret. I thought it was amazing, because nothing's a secret now,
right?
You know, if you want to, you know, the whole goddamn movie before you go see it, because everything's spoiled, and I don't like the spoiling, you know.
Right.
I think it takes away from that stuff. When I was a kid, you got to see a movie and that was it. And then you live that movie in your mind so vividly forever after that. You never got to see it. Maybe it'd be re-released in a year or two. Maybe, you know. And so the stuff was so impactful. I mean, when I saw like Planet of the Apes when I was 8, I mean, that I didn't know what was happening, you know. Right. That was what, for everyone usually my age, that's pretty much the mark there. Hmm. You know, I grew up on your Universal stuff, but then you were 8 or 9 years old and you went and saw Planet of the Apes. And then you were like, okay, well, that's it. I have to, we have to do ape makeups. We have to,
of course.
We have to be apes. You know what I mean? And that's probably the biggest movie it's ever impacted. I think that's my favorite movie of all time.
Hmm. It is interesting.
Yeah, okay. That and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea is one of my favorite movies of all time. And, but the, you know, that favorite movies of all time can go on a list of 100 movies.
Sure. Yeah, so you have a top 10 or top 50.
I love film noir movies, and I love anything in that genre from Warner Brothers. I just think it's great.
Yeah.
I want to go see Nightmare Alley this weekend. That just came out.
Right, of course.
Yes. Really cool. And I love most of his movies. It's supposed to be really different than most of his.
Oh, really?
Non-fantasy and more debunking fantasy from the reviews I read.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Because they're like con people.
Mm.
They're right. Carny cons. And it kind of debunks any sort of fantasy or because they're mind readers and stuff, but it's all fake. So I can't wait to see it. It should be really interesting. And then, of course, we worked on Shape of Water at Legacy and built that suit for Doug Jones, which was really fun. Well, I don't know how fun it was, but it was really, you know, work's not that fun. But the finished product and everything was really cool because we got to make a fish man, even though most people were like, it looks like Ape Sapien. I'm like, yeah, well, a fish man looks like a fish like man.
Fish man, right, right.
But it's, you know, if you have an eye and really look at it, it's completely different. So yeah, you got to really look. You can't just go, it's a fish man, it's the same guy. And I thought that was a really cool movie. I like that. That was fun to work.
I mean, it's clear that you are passionate about everything you do. I mean, like you said, it's work, but it's also something that you're passionate about and you get a chance to be creative and work around others who feel the same way, which I think is incredible that you're able to do that.
Yeah, you lose that fascination after a while where it's like really a buzz to go to the shop. Because, I mean, when I was, well, I was 32 when I started, but still younger. Yeah. And it had never been, you know, so when I was first in makeup shops, it'd be like, oh, fuck, look, fucking Freddy Krueger makeup. That's fucking awesome, you know? Or this thing, or the guy you worked for had, you know, Todd Masters worked on Ghostbusters. He used to be part of Boss Films, which was Steve Johnson, and who ran Boss Films for a while. Well, it was Ghostbusters and all those iconic movies that happened then. That was basically makeup. You basically had Boss Films, and that was the makeup department. Of course, they did a little digital, early digital and stuff like that, you know.
Right.
But yeah, I remember this. So it'd always be a buzz, and we'd spend all day and night in the shop working, not even getting paid, because we were all still learning from each other and learning and still just fascinated. And then, you know, you do that for 20 years that it wears off, you know, and it's like, oh yeah, okay, another, okay, okay, and another, right. You know, and then really cool things pop up. Remember even, went to get to work on The Crow, and that was the first time we kind of went from Todd Masters, and the guy I started with, Scott Coulter, continued to work for Todd, and then he worked on his own, Scott did, with Lance Anderson. So he called me up, and another guy who worked for Todd, Scott Patton, who actually is a designer at Legacy now, and he said, oh, we got this, come over and interview over at Anderson's, and it's gonna be better than Batman, you know. We're like, better than Batman? What? and it was The Crow, and there were like four of us worked in his shop on that stuff, and that was a fun experience too. Oh, of course, until they didn't finish the movie, and the boss came back and was like, hey, come get all your merch. You know, it was the day when you still, if you worked on a film, you got all kinds of swag. Oh. You got all kinds of merch, which barely happens anymore. You don't even get to go see screenings anymore. But that was sad. So I went over, and Lance and his wife were there, and they were really upset. And, you know, and it was like this awesome jacket with a giant crow patch on it and a hat with a crow patch on it that was like a specially made thing, and some cups, all kinds of great swag, which I have stored somewhere. And it was like, well, this is really cool, but is the film dead? You know, it's going to be over. And of course it wasn't, you know, they went and fixed it and stuff.
Sure. Yes. And,
another cool thing, and Scott Coulter, who, like I said, I started with and then met other guys through him, like Todd. Scott Coulter and Lance were the only two guys that went out and did all the stuff on The Crow, did all the makeups, and then did that zombie makeup on Michael Berryman, which was, they didn't use, of course, because he was the skull cowboy, his cowboy with the skull face. Really awesome makeup Lance did, and they cut him out of the film, which was weird. I don't know why. Anyway, so they were the only two out there doing all the makeup effects. And Scott Coulter had his cat, and he was going to be out there for so long, he brought his cat with him. And of course they had apartments, you know, and a big hurricane came through at one point when they were shooting. Like, they hadn't been there that long, and the cat ran away. So his cat's in another state, you know, in North Carolina, gone, you know, California cat. Anyways, and then they continue to shoot the movie. Boom. Brandon dies, that tragedy happens. And Scott, well, they're all going home. They didn't know what was, so they were all coming back to California. And Scott goes back to his apartment and is packing up all his stuff. And his cat came back. Like, now, cat's been gone for a month or so in a strange place.
Oh my gosh.
And that freaked him out. He didn't know what to think of that. He was already upset beyond belief because they were all there when it happened, you know,
right
there. And then his cat walked back. I just thought, always thought that was kind of
the cat cool came thing. Back, right? That's what they say. So, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Walter, for sharing. I think, you know, what's clear to me again is that you've really just have pursued what you wanted to do. I mean, ever since a young age, you've been sort of drawn to this, whether it's the monsters or makeup effects or music, you've been able to pursue and live that life. And I think that's incredible. A lot of people don't do that. So I think that's the story that I'm getting from you as you tell this today.
You can do whatever you want to do.
Yeah. It seems so simple when you say it like that.
I know. And it seemed, but it just, you just do. I mean, you just do it. I don't know.
No,
that's how I do things.
Listen, I love it. It's a very laid back approach. And a lot of times people overcomplicate things, and it's
they
a simple
do.
But
and
powerful
and,
message.
Yeah. I lived in California my whole life. And during COVID summer, I mean, I moved to Oregon, where I have a little bit of family up here. Mm-hmm. And so I moved to a really rural town up here. It was like 30,000 people in this town. So, which is going to be my retirement place.
Sure.
And luckily my older sister had already lived here, and her niece, and they're raising their family here. And it's really beautiful and kicked back, very wet, but it's great. And,
yeah.
And I can afford to live here, actually, as even the California is so bad. I mean, I could, it sometimes doesn't matter how much money you make down there, make a pretty good living. And I was always strapped, strapped.
Wow.
And you know, it's impossible to buy a house, you know, I mean, you got to make a lot of freaking money.
I'm sure.
And I'm basically a blue collar guy, you know, always have been. I always tell people that, you know, a blue collar worker, you know?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're making it work, and moving to Oregon helps. For
I did
sure.
that almost further. I mean, we did it within 2 weeks. I went back to Legacy, and COVID did a lot of things to a lot of people, but I didn't think I was affected that much, but obviously I was. And I was like, I live with my sister and my son. And I said, we got to get out of California. Let's go. And in 2 weeks, we were moved up here, and now we live here. So I was like, you just do it.
Yeah. No, I love that message. Like, you see something you want to do, just do it. And but thank you. I want to thank you for sharing about that today, kind of getting a little bit of an insight into your life. And, you know, I don't know if you know this, but each show, the topic and the title comes out as a result of the conversation. So I think that just do it mentality may be something very similar to this title, because I think you're a living example of that. So thank you for sharing that and talking today a bit on the show.
Thanks, man.
That's my pleasure. And of course, I do want to thank the listeners and viewers out there for tuning into Brain Burrow. And on behalf of Walter Phelan, this is Mark DiValenti. Have an amazing rest of your day.
Thank you. And this is Dr. Satan signing out.
Love that. Thank you.
All right.
You just dug deep with Mark D. Do you want more? Follow Mark on Instagram @ValentiHorror and subscribe to the Brain Burrow podcast.